for Angelique. Small crowd tonight. No real shock there being it's holiday and our Sunday crowd, but those of you that are out, really appreciate you being here and making the efforts here in this nice, warm, sunny Memorial Day weekend here with 90 degrees outside. It's a little too much like summer. Rachel likes the summer. It's a little too much like summer for me, but I can feel the air blowing on my bald head right here, and I currently like this location. If you want to open up your Bible, you can open up to 1 Kings, the 20th chapter. We will spend all our time tonight in 1 Kings chapter 20 and 1 Kings chapter 21. So all our time will be in that particular text. I'm going to throw some words up on the board. I want you to tell me if you know these words. The words are sullen, vexed, and despondent or despondently. It might be some words that you use, and it might be kind of like our paradox. They're words that we've heard, but like it would be difficult to say, okay, now this is the definition of sullen. But maybe you've got an idea about what it means to be sullen, or maybe what it means to be vexed. Despondent is probably the one that we hear more often in our English language, the idea of being maybe beat down to the point of there is no hope type of thing. But I found it interesting as I was looking at the character that many people believe to be the worst king of Israel and potentially the worst king of all of them for quite some time. That would be King Ahab. And as Marvin read for us in 1 Kings chapter 20 and verse 43, that the king of Israel went to his house, vexed and sullen, and came to Samaria. We have these words, vexed and sullen, is how the English Standard translates it here. New American Standard flips it around. Sullen and vexed. The King James says heavy and vexed. So like whatever translation you're using, it's using a different word, so guess what? That makes it even more confusing as to what these things are. But I want you to notice that the same words are used of Ahab in chapter 21 and verse 4. That Ahab went to his house vexed and sullen, or sullen and vexed, okay? So the same words are used. So what in the world are these words in which Ahab goes to his house? Let's put them back up here, right? Sullen. The word is apparently someone who is sad, and why the King James translates it heavy is because it's something that kind of goes down. It's sad, but there is a tint of anger to it apparently. That it is not a you're just upset about it, but you're upset and angry about it at the same time. So have you ever had a situation where you were, in this case, and I'm going to use the New American Standard of that, sullen, where you were sad about something and yet at the same time angry about that very thing in which you're sad about? Well, that was what Ahab was feeling that day. But also he was vexed. Well, what is vexed? That is our word for enraged. So you've got somebody who is sad, angry, and enraged, right? That's not a happy camper going to his house. And that's what he was on two separate occasions. I want you to think about maybe what that looks like. Ever seen a kid throw a temper tantrum? They're sad because they didn't get to do what they wanted to do. And they are angry that they didn't get to do what they wanted to do. And so what do? They yell, they scream, they kick, they cry, they do all of the things, and it is a temper tantrum. That is what I picture is happening with Ahab on the way back to his house. It's getting dirty, he's like getting his chariot, that poor horse that he's riding is getting whipped. And he is throwing an adult temper tantrum. Do you have an adult ever throw a temper tantrum? I got some yeses in the room. Michael says no. I got the honest people saying yes. We don't like to think of ourselves similar to Ahab, do we? But yet old Ahab threw a temper tantrum, and he didn't just throw one. This seems to be a kind of common character flaw of Ahab. So what brought him to this? And now our third word you see at the end of chapter 21 is that he walked about, and you can flip down to verse 27. That Ahab heard these words, he tore his clothes, he put on sackcloth on his flesh, and he fasted, he lay in sackcloth, and he went about dejectedly or despondently, or maybe this is the one that the King James says, heavy, softly. Yes, softly. Because softly is apparently a way to translate this. But it carries this idea of something that is slow. So he's walking around slowly, and we're going to see that this walk is different than his sullen and vexed walk. But yet, I just found it interesting that he threw a temper tantrum twice, and I personally normally only think of Ahab throwing a temper tantrum once. So what brought him to his first temper tantrum? Well, it started last war season. And you go back to chapter 20, and I don't know about you, but I don't really know when war season is. But we know that in the text, that after the first battle, prophet comes and says, hey, Ahab, he's coming back, so go ahead and get ready for it. So this thing's kind of been building up. And you remember, maybe it was last year, Michael preached a sermon on the last straw. It was either last year or the year before last, I can't remember. But it's like oftentimes when we break, it's actually not the thing that happens right there that causes us to break. It's a build-up over time, and that's just the last straw. That's just the thing that you couldn't take anymore. Well, it's kind of the same thing with Ahab's temper tantrum. This thing has been building up for at least two seasons of war. Okay, so you pick up in chapter 20 of 1 Kings, and what we have is the king of Assyria, Ben-Hadad, coming down with about 32 other kings to bring war against Israel, against Ahab. And you'll notice down in verse 2 that Ben-Hadad says to the king of Israel through his messengers, your silver, your gold are mine, your best wives and your children are mine. King comes into town and he doesn't even say this to your face, but he sends his messengers and says, I'm taking everything you got. Your possessions are mine, and the best of what you got are mine. And Ahab originally says, okay. But then his people say, you can't let him do that to you. So he says, no, he refuses to give that to him. You can see that down in verse 9, that Ahab refused him. You tell my lord the king, all that you first demanded of your servant I will do, but this thing I cannot do. You've gone too far, Ben-Hadad. I will not give you my stuff. Well, as you can imagine, old Ben-Hadad is not super pleased with that. But Ben-Hadad has a problem himself. He's got a problem that he likes to drink. And he and the other kings are out drinking. And in fact, they're even drinking in verse 16 at noon. So it must have been football Sunday or football Saturday or something because they're out drinking at noon. No, wait, what time is it? It's war time. And they're out drinking when they should be going to war. But before they get demolished in war, which is what happens, a prophet comes to Ahab. Now we know Ahab to be a very idolatrous individual. In fact, he even introduced some other idols into Israel. But notice down in verse 13 that, behold, a prophet came near to Ahab, king of Israel, and he said, thus says the Lord, have you seen this great multitude? Behold, I will give it into your hand this day, and you shall know that I am the Lord, I am Jehovah. You see, there was a huge army out there. In fact, they were kind of described as big old flock, and there was just a couple goats, is all Israel was. They were basically nothing. And this prophet tells Ahab, this king's demanding all your stuff, and he's got all these other kings, but I'm giving you this victory. The Lord is giving this victory so that you will know that I am Jehovah. Well, while those kings, he says, well, how am I going to know? How's it going to go about? He says, your governors are going to do it. Your governors are going to give you this victory. So lo and behold, while King of Syria and his other kings are out drinking, guess what happens? They sneak up on him and they whip him. I mean, they put a hurting on them. And so if you look down in verse 20 here of the text of chapter 20, that each of Israel's men, they struck down his man. And the Syrians fled and Israel pursued them. But Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, escaped on a horse with horsemen. And the king of Israel went out and he struck the horses and the chariots and he struck the Syrians with a great blow. Like he goes and he puts a hurting on that army, but the king gets away. And he gets away with some other horsemen and so off he goes. Well, Ahab may think, we got this thing under control. This thing is great. I showed Ben-Hadad what's up. He's not getting my stuff. Get on out of town. Well, that's when the prophet comes back. And the prophet comes back to him in verse 22. And he came near to the king of Israel and he said, come, strengthen yourself. And consider well what you have to do, for in the spring the king of Syria will come up against you. He's not done with you. He's coming back. And again, here's prophecy in that sense, right? He's coming back and guess what the prophet says he's going to do? You're going to get this thing again. And the reason is because the king of Syria explains his defeat in this way. Look in verse 23. They said to him, their gods are the gods of the hills. And so they were stronger than we. But let us fight against them in the plain and surely we shall be stronger than they. Their reason for getting defeated was, well, okay, we fought them in the wrong place. Israel's God is a God that really works well in the mountains. But let's go fight him in the plain and let's see whose God is stronger in the plain because we're from the plains, we got this junk down. Well, the prophet comes back to him again and you'll notice down in verse 26, that the prophet says, hey, they're coming, but he will give it into your hand. So verse 28, so the man of God came near and he said to the king of Israel, thus says Jehovah, behold, the Syrians have said, Jehovah is a God of the hills, he's not a God of the valleys. Therefore, I will give all this great multitude into your hand, and you shall know that I am Jehovah. Well, guess what happened? They do. They put an even bigger hurt on them. I want you to notice in verse 29 that Israel that day struck down 100,000 soldiers. Can you even imagine how many each of those soldiers had to kill to get 100,000 dead? The blood that would have been out there? The bodies that were just laying out there? We are talking about a massive victory. We're talking about, what, half of Newark is dead at the hands of this army? You would have to know something was up, right? You shall know that I am Jehovah. And on top of that, not only were 100,000 killed by the soldiers, one wall fell down and killed 27,000. So now we got 127,000 dead bodies. I can't remember the number that was at 9/11, but it was nowhere near that. Just a couple thousand, a few thousand, right? 104? Under 4,000. 127,000 bodies laying on the floor. That's a big victory, isn't it? Well, but one, it got away. The king of Assyria, or the king of Syria, escapes again. Notice the end of verse 30. Ben-Hadad also fled and entered a chamber in the city. So if you're Ben-Hadad, what are you going to do now? I've just come back up against them with at least 127,000. And we got defeated. So what do you do if you can't defeat your enemy? You make peace with him. Notice how he tries to make peace with Ahab. So he comes to him in verse 32. They tied sackcloth around their waist and they put on robes on their heads. And they went to the king of Israel and they said, "Your servant Ben-Hadad says, please let me live." Does he still live? He's my brother. What? How is Ahab saying that Ben-Hadad is his brother? He's just come wanting all his stuff. He's come bringing war against him, but yet he says he's my brother. So now the men, they were watching for a sign. And yes, your brother Ben-Hadad, he's alive, bring him. So they brought him, verse 34. And here's Ben-Hadad's peace offering. "The cities that my father took from your father, I will restore. And you may establish bazaars for yourself in Damascus as my father did in Samaria." What's the peace offering? "I'll give you the lands that we've already taken back that my father took from your father. So here you go." And Ahab said, "Sounds good. I will let you go on these terms." So he made a covenant with him and let him go. They said, "Well, that's nice of Ahab." Well, why did Ahab do that? Ahab wanted the land. So, prophet does something very interesting. War is over with. Ben-Hadad is able to go back to Syria. So one of the strangest prophecies, we think about Hosea having to do a strange thing, right? Hosea had to go and marry a prostitute. Very strange. But this is in probably the top five of the strangest things that a prophet has to do. A prophet is commanded by the Lord, verse 35, to go up to one of his fellows, in verse 35, and command by the Lord to strike me, please. So what was this guy's, what was this prophet's message? You go up to somebody and say, "Hit me." And the first person that he went up to and he said, "Hit me," the man refused to hit him. If somebody comes up to you at command of the Lord and says, "Hit me," how many of us are throwing a punch? Like, I gotta tell you, that's a strange thing that I'm being told to do. And you know what happens to this man that refused this? The prophet says to him, "Because you refuse the word of the Lord, you're going to be devoured by a lion." So the man went on his way, and guess what? Immediately, he was devoured by a lion. Because he didn't punch a guy. What? How crazy is that? So guess what? You think the story's over with. Prophet's told again. You go find another man. So he goes and he finds another man. "Hit me. Strike me." Well, this one actually strikes him. And he doesn't give him a love tap. But you can notice in your text, down in verse 37, that the man struck him and he wounded him. That's crazy. The guy hit him hard enough that he's got bruises. He's got wounds on him. And so the prophet goes and he disguises himself. And he makes sure that he gets to King Ahab. And so he tells the story. So notice verse 39. "So as the king passed by, he cried to the king and he said, 'Your servant went out in the midst of the battle, and behold, a soldier turned and brought a man to me and said, guard this man. And if by any means he is missing, your life shall be for his life, or else you shall pay a talent of silver.' And as your servant was busy here and there, he was gone." Well, what's the story he tells him? "I was out in the battle. I was told to watch this dude. And if the dude got away, then I have to give my life for his life. Or else, I've got to be able to pay for his life." So he says to the king, or the king says to him, the king of Israel said to him, "So shall your judgment be. You yourself have decided it. You said it for yourself. You know what your punishment is. So are you going to pay the money or are you going to give up your life?" And then, verse 41, he hurried to take the bandage away from his eyes, and the king recognized him as one of the prophets. And the prophet said, "Behold, says the Lord, because you have let go out of your hand the man whom I devoted to destruction, therefore your life shall be for his life, and your people for his people." And the king went to his house vexed and sorrowful. He went sad and angry and threw a temper tantrum. Why? Because his life was now required. Isn't it nice to show mercy to people? I thought we were supposed to be merciful to people. But not when God can't show mercy to that individual. God says, "I wanted this guy destroyed. And you let him go because you wanted lambs. So guess what, Ahab? You knew that I wanted him dead and you let him go." Remember another king that knew he wanted, God wanted another king dead and he let him go? Saul, right? And what was required of Saul? His kingdom was required of that. When God wants something done, and when God wants judgment done on an individual, who am I to be merciful to that individual? That is not my job. My job is to bring about the judgment that the Lord has placed on that individual. Mercy doesn't always win in this case. And Ahab went home, and he was all angry. And he was all sad, and he was in a rage. Because he's now going to die. Well, that gets us to chapter 21, the second time that it's used. This is the more familiar story with us, I imagine, with Naboth's vineyard. You see, ever in his palace, in his house, he could look out the window, that is Ahab, and he could see this beautiful vineyard. He could see this beautiful vegetable garden, some of your translations would say. Whatever it is, it's a beautiful piece of land. And notice what Ahab does in verse 2. So Ahab, now let's just read verse 1. So now Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard in Jezreel beside the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria. And after this, Ahab said to Naboth, "Give me your vineyard, that I may have it for a vegetable garden, because it is near my house, and I will give you a better vineyard for it. Or if it seems good to you, I will give you its value in money." But Naboth said, "Ahab, no, no, no." I want you to think about what just happened. Ahab comes on the scene, and what does he do? He demands another man's possession. Isn't that what the king of Syria did to him? He came in and says, "I'm taking the best of your best." He comes to Naboth and he says, "I'm taking your land." But he doesn't just say, "I'm just going to take it from you." He says, "I'll trade you. I'll give you a better piece of land." Well, if it's a better piece of land, then why isn't the king using it? "Well, I'll give you another piece of land, or I'll give you whatever money it costs. I'll give you the value of it." That's pretty fair, right? Like, the king's just not just going out and just taking it for himself. He's at least willing to buy the land, or at least trade. But because of the value to Naboth, Naboth says, "No money is going to pay for this." Because remember, this has been given to Naboth's family by the Lord and had been handed down, verse 3, as an inheritance. Are there some things that you've been handed down maybe from your family that no one could pay you enough for because of the value of that? That was what that was to Naboth. That land was so valuable to him that no amount of money was going to buy him off. Well, when the king got refused, yes, as we already pointed out, what did he do? Well, verse 4, Ahab went into his house, vexed and sullen, or sullen and vexed, are exact same words. He throws a temper tantrum and he sits on his bed and he turned away his face and he would not eat food. What a baby. You ever find yourself in that situation? Where you were just so angry and upset and so sad, I just refuse to do anything until I get my way. We're Ahab. We're just like Ahab. And so his beautiful, godly wife Jezebel, oh wait, she was probably beautiful, but she was not godly, right? Walks in and she sees her husband throwing a temper tantrum. So verse 5, Jezebel saw his wife came in and said to him, "Why is your spirit so vexed that you've eaten no food? Why are you so angry that you haven't even eaten? You're the king. Do something about this." And Ahab just kind of sits there like a knot on the log, angry and upset. And Jezebel, the doer of the family, says, "Come on now, let's get rid of Naboth." So they had to come up with a way to get rid of Naboth, right? So they say, "Hey, call all the elders of the city together and get two people to sit close to Naboth and bring up some false charges against him." So they bring up false charges against him, and lo and behold, they had to drag him out of the city, stone him, the dogs licked up his blood, all that good stuff. And I want you to flip down to verse 16 now. Look down to verse 16. And it, oh, it might help if I'm in the right chapter. I was about to say they were drinking at noon, but that's chapter 20, verse 16 here. So, as soon as Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned and was dead, verse 15, Jezebel said, "Ahab, arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give you for money. For Naboth is not alive, he's dead." And as soon as Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, Ahab arose to go down to the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to take possession of it. As soon as he heard the words, "The man is dead, I'm taking it." Well, what about his family? What about that being passed down? The king was going to have none of that. Now, we don't know if Naboth actually had any family to hand it down to or not, do we? Doesn't matter. Didn't matter to Ahab. That land is now open, and so I will take possession of it. What does that sound like Ahab really likes? Ahab likes land, doesn't he? He can be bought with land. Well, as soon as you heard it, he went down. So he took possession of this thing. And I don't know what this thing looked like, but he took possession. And Elijah the prophet is sent to Ahab while he is in the vineyard. And I find that to be very interesting. Look down with me now to verse 19. "You shall say to him, 'Have you killed and also taken possession?'" Hold on. Did Ahab kill Naboth? Do you think he knew what Jezebel was going to do to get that land? I think he knew. She was going to take care of Naboth. You ever hear that? I don't know the exact phrase of it, but it's the idea of, "I know what you're going to do, but don't tell me so that I don't know what you're going to do. But we're going to benefit from the thing in which we don't want to know about, but yet we know that they're going to do." Right? Are we not implicitly giving them permission to do that? We are basically saying, "Yep, it's okay for you to go and do what you're going to do, even though that thing is wrong. As long as I don't know about it, I will reap the benefits of that." It seems as though that's probably what happened. When he could have stood up to his wife and been like, "He told me he wasn't going to sell it to me. I'll get over this." But that was not what Ahab did. "I want that land. So if you got to kill him, you got to kill him. But I'm not going to do it." Well, God says, "You killed and he took possession." It would be interesting to say, well, I didn't kill him. Well, Ahab knows that ain't going to fly, right? So notice kind of going here in your text here. That just like the dogs ate or licked the blood of Naboth, so shall the dogs lick your blood. That's pretty a disgusting picture. Yeah, Jenny over here is like, ugh, right? That's pretty disgusting to think about licking of the blood. And Elijah is Ahab's enemy. Elijah, my enemy. Elijah never says anything good to Ahab. Just like in the next chapter, Micaiah never says anything good to Ahab. You know why? Because they're speaking from the Lord, and the Lord doesn't have anything good to say to Ahab. But they hate the messenger, Elijah, my enemy. Now, you remember what he said was going to happen because he let the king of Syria go away? What was going to be required of him? His life. What was just told of him here? You're going to die, and they're going to lick your blood, the dogs. But notice verse 21. Behold, the Lord says, I will bring disaster upon you, and I will utterly burn you up, and will cut off from Ahab every male, bond or free in Israel. And I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah, for the anger to which you have provoked me, and because you have made Israel to sin. What did he just say he was going to do? His lineage as a king is going to be cut off. He is not going to have a continual lineage. Then verse 23. And of Jezebel, Jehovah said, the dog shall eat Jezebel within the walls of Jezreel. And anyone belonging to Ahab who dies in the city, the dog shall eat. And anyone who is his, who dies in the open country, the birds of the heavens will eat. That's not what's supposed to happen to kings and their families. Kings are supposed to get burials. Queens are supposed to get burials. Princes are supposed to get big funerals. But no, that is not going to be the case with Ahab and his family. So Ahab, not only are you going to die, your wife and all of your sons will die. So notice verse 27 very carefully. And when Ahab heard those words, he tore his clothes, he put on sackcloth on his flesh, and he fasted, and he lay in sackcloth, and he went about dejectedly or despondent. He was not sullen and vexed this time. He did the opposite of a temper tantrum. A temper tantrum, you get somebody up and they're all in a tizzy, right? He's walking around, as your translation may say, softly, gently. And the idea is he's walking around slowly. That's a different reaction than what he's just had when he received news about his own self. But you'll notice the Lord recognizes this. Verse 29, he says to Elijah, have you seen how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Because he humbled himself before me, I will not bring the disaster in his days, but in his son's days I will bring the disaster upon his house. What brought about the humility this time? God recognizes that this is different. His walking around is not the same. I find it interesting that this time he's not the only one that is addressed. In the previous situations, he's the one. Your life for his life. And you will die for this. But this go around, his family was brought into it. I want you to think about how humiliating it is when you realize how much damage you have done to your own family. Maybe something that you didn't even set out and realize you brought on them. And you take a step back, or you get hit between the eyes, and you realize, man, I really caused them a lot of trouble. I don't know if there's a much more humiliating thing than that. To know that my family is going to be murdered because of me. David had to go through that, didn't he? There the sword would not depart his own house. There was civil war in his house. I think Ahab, there's something about it, because notice that as soon as he heard these words about his wife and his sons, or maybe it was that his kingdom was going to be taken away. But whatever it was, it got him to think. And it got him to realize he needed to humble himself. And the Lord responded to that. Even the worst king in Israel at that time, and that's what verse 25 and verse 26 is saying about Ahab. He was the worst. But yet when he humbled himself before God truly and honestly, guess what God did? God says, I'll relent. I'm not changing what I'm going to do to you. It is just not going to take place in your lifetime. It's not going to be as bad as it could have been. Because you don't have to see your sons die. Unlike which king was it? Zedekiah? That had to see all his sons killed right before his eyes, and then his eyes were plucked out. And that is, God's not doing that to Ahab. I thought about maybe something else that brought it to him. Maybe he came to the same conclusion that he realized he did the same thing to Naboth that the king of Syria had done with him. He came in and he's demanding stuff. And he just takes it. You ever been humiliated when you realize the thing that somebody did to you that really hurt you, that really bothered you? You then turn around and realize you did the same thing to somebody else. How that puts me in my place and humiliates me. I wonder if he came to that conclusion. He definitely did not come to that conclusion at the beginning of chapter 21. That was not his immediate reaction when he takes it away, but maybe now it is. Maybe he realizes, man, I'm really no different than this awful guy. I did the same thing. And I think sometimes it's hard for us to put ourselves and see ourselves that my sin, even though it is different than someone else's sin, in God's eyes is still the same sin. It's sin. Sin is sin. But when I realize, man, my sin of lying is no different than a sin of murder, that's pretty humiliating to think that God's going to hold me a liar and that murderer equal. I'm better than that murderer. I didn't murder anybody. Yeah, but you lied, right? Isn't that kind of the argument in James chapter 2? The person is bragging because they didn't do this or that. They didn't murder, they didn't steal. But he says, yeah, but you didn't keep all the commandments. You fall in one point, you're held accountable to all things. I think that's pretty humiliating when we realize, hey, my sin is exactly the same as what I picture to be the worst. Or maybe the actual humiliating side of things, I realize I did the exact same thing and I hate that. That's a humbling thing. And then thirdly and finally, the last thing, is that maybe the right thing came about and he realized he had disobeyed the Lord. Maybe he realized he was supposed to kill King Assyria and he wishes he had done that. Or maybe he realizes, you know what, I should have let that go and I knew I shouldn't murder and I knew I shouldn't covet and I knew I shouldn't do all of those things. And I actually feel bad for disobeying the word of the Lord, the one who gave me this huge victory over this huge enemy. Maybe that's what it was. But I think for you and I, we should be humbled when we don't obey the word of the Lord, because we realize we should be obeying the word of the Lord. I know for a fact that it seems to, I shouldn't say I know for a fact that it seems, that is completely wrong. It seems to me that the thing that motivated Ahab the most in this situation was what it was going to do to his family. But I'd like to think that maybe some of these other things came into play as well. Or at least, they should come into play in my life. That make sense? Very cool. Well, I'm done. Maybe you are ready tonight to be baptized into Christ. Or maybe you need the prayers of the congregation here. Now would be as good a time as any. So why don't you come now as we stand and as we sing.